Hello, Camilla Sheila. Nice
Hello, Tammy Blunter.
nice to see you. I'm very sorry we're not in your room together. Whenever we've recorded conversations in the past, it's always been in the same space, often your kitchen, sometimes your garden, your living room. How are you feeling? How are you feeling today?
I'm quite chipper, really. I've just been talking to an old friend who's been here. And it's a nice day in London. We're having a period of really pleasant early summer weather, which of course is not going to last. There'll be some thunderstorms in a week's time, and then it's going to do the usual thing. It's just going to rain all summer. But right now it's beautiful, not too hot, not too many insects, and everyone's just strolling around enjoying it. So London's great right now.
Yeah, it's good that you're back in London, I suppose.
It is good. There's no suppose.
There's no, it is good. Oh, I'm glad to hear it because I wasn't sure how it would be for you coming back from the countryside to London.
It's good in every way. I'm so happy to be back in London.
Oh, fab. Oh, yeah. That's great.
No question about that.
Well, I'll be over in June, so we might get to coincide yet in real life.
I hope so. I'll try to stick around for you.
Yeah, that's very kind. So, hey, people listening to this, there are many reasons to talk to you. We've had, I think I counted something like 10 or 11 conversations in the past 10 or 11 years, something like that, on this podcast or something like it. And usually we talk about meditation, landscape, maybe some of that will come out today. But there's a particular reason that I asked, could we talk today? And in a way, I think it'd be better to hear that from you rather than me trying to sort of parse it as an event or something.
Well, I've had a terminal cancer diagnosis, number one. That's prompted certain amount of self-reflection and, you know, following on from that, we haven't met up for ages. You suggested we talk again. It's a good time to talk.
Yeah.
Still fairly talkative. Yeah, some things in the background.
I was reading your blog, this kind of new blog you're doing about your cancer voyage, I think is the sort of way you've been talking about it.
I need to change the name, I think. It's called My Voyage into the Unknown.
What's wrong with that? I like that. What's it going to be
called?
It's all
right. Maybe it is okay.
Maybe we'll talk about voyages later, but I read the story, your recent entry about losing your tooth, which I think was called
Tooth. Right.
Yeah. A very, very beautifully written little thing. It actually made me regret a bit that I haven't seen more of your writing outside of, you know, direct meditation writing. You're a good writer. It was very, very...
I'm not a great writer, but I can I can do it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was very evocative. And
I'm getting better. Oh, yeah. Don't judge it by the blog. No.
Well, I felt grateful to you for taking the time to share that experience. I mean, you could just have had that experience with your partner and it would have been meaningful anyway, but you did something with it. And I know you're also recording with Padma Mati, your friend.
Yeah.
What's prompted you to try and do some amount, at least, of documentation of this process of dying rather than it just being a private process with friends and family?
Well, I haven't decided to do that. You decided to do it and Padma Mati decided to do it. They just
he said yes. We asked.
Yeah, I just said yes to the suggestions.
Well, I suppose the blog is a kind of documentation from you, isn't it?
I feel it's as though since I've been doing retreats online, I've been in contact with so many order members and other non-order members as well. I mean, it's hundreds of people. And of course, I had to tell them about the cancer. And that it just sets up an atmosphere in which I feel I need to tell people about it a bit. So that's what I did. That's what the blog was about. And then, you know, you asked if you could interview me. Great idea. Mm. Pabloty did as well. Yeah. That is as far as it goes.
So it's a bit incidental in the way to your own process of it. It's just like you're happy
it's
to go.
It's just one of those things, yeah.
People like me who say, can we talk about this?
Yeah. I'm very happy to talk to you anyway.
Yeah, I'm very happy to talk to you too. It's it is odd doing it remotely, but, you know, it's been funny listening to the podcasts with you, just revisiting them a bit, picking up on various dynamics. And also you as an interviewee, you're quite playful and impish.
I prefer a dialogue rather than interview. I like to respond to you.
Yeah, that's right.
And I like to get a sense of who I'm talking to. Who is the huge unseen audience, you know, behind us who's going to be listening and watching, especially the curated sound podcasts that you're going to make. Who's going to listen? Who am I talking to? It makes a difference.
Yeah, it does. It was interesting to look at the stats. Usually 1,000 people or so listen to these episodes. Well, I think what we're trying to do with this kind of curated media thing, which is a bit artificial, is just let people drop in on connection between people. There's not really much more to it than that, and the stories that come out and the voices, and you know,
this is true. Yeah.
So our connection, for people who are listening who don't know Kamal Sheila and don't know me, we met, I think, 31 years ago.
My God.
You've been ordained for 50 years.
Was that when I tried to get you to come out to McDonald's for breakfast after that for 2 years?
I don't think so. I think that was later. No, we met in a women's community, oddly, in Glasgow 31 years ago. You were leading a meditation weekend.
Oh, yes, I do remember now, yes.
It's an interesting little thing to note that you were there right at the start of my engagement with Buddhism and the Dharma and stuff. And I guess that's one of the reasons people care about you so much, is because you've been there for a long time. It's 50 years, isn't it? You've been ordained for 50 years. Yeah, 1974.
That's right. It's this year. It's this November.
It's this year.
I may stick around for that as well. Let's see. November. November 74 was the...
November 74. Can you remember which date in November?
The 9th.
And was that in Italy, at Il Convento? Or?
Italy hadn't been thought of. No, it was in the Thetford Forest in Norfolk. One of the 20 or so order members had a tumble-down old cottage there. It was very close to where the US Army actually have a base. Oh. And every so often you'd have these massive jets taking off in the middle of everything. Everyone would have to just go, just freeze for a few minutes while these great big jets took off. Yeah, it was great. Thetford Forest is just fir trees. It's one of those woods that you get in the UK where it's just cultivated timber. It's going to be chopped down and turned into floorboards. So it wasn't really a lovely forest you could kind of walk through, is my memory anyway. It's just lots of pine trees vying for space. Sorry, I'm digressing, aren't I?
No, you're not. It's wonderful that you're digressing. Oh. One thing that I noticed, just you sort of remembering there, I did wonder about memory generally. We live in this kind of way where we know rationally that we're time constrained, but we don't live as if we are. We don't live forever, but we live as if we do sometimes, at least on some level.
No, I'm still doing it. It's all right.
Yeah. Well, it was very interesting you having this very strong, scientifically backed up awareness that you've got some months to live. And I wondered, one of the first things I thought when I was thinking about it and noticing how I felt was, gosh, with limited amounts of time, not just how do you practice, what do you think about, but what do you remember? There's a poem by Seamus Heaney, I think, that says something like, my last things will be first things slipping from me. And I sort of wondered about the role of memory in just coming to terms with the time scale.
Mm. Well, maybe one would expect this, but well, I do find memories coming up more than usual. Mm. A little bit more. It's not dramatically so. My dream life is much more vivid than it was before I got the diagnosis. That's happening. I'm not having any dramatic changes in what comes up in the chitter, the mind.
It's kind of business as usual for your psyche.
To be honest, it's just been incredibly busy. Dying is one of the most busiest things you can do. You wouldn't believe the number of people who are in my head at the moment. Mm. First of all, there's the whole process of getting diagnosed and seeing lots of different doctors, having quite intensive conversations with them and going to different places, different hospitals, different hospital wards. And it's all completely unaccustomed. And it's so important to remember what the doctor said. It's just full of all of that. And then there are all the hundreds of people that I, at least, have let know, first of all, that I have cancer, and secondly, that I have terminal cancer. And obviously, they all want to write and say, I'm terribly sorry, and I hope this, and I can remember this incident. So I'm very, very full up with memories and thoughts and just facts about people I know. And it's on a quite a big scale. And people come, I'm trying to limit it to a couple of visits a day. You're one of them. And had my friend Kula Mitra come around just before we started. I'm normally quite reclusive, you know.
Yeah.
I'm normally quite reclusive and I appreciate my own company. Not at the expense of, I love my friends, but I also really appreciate being on my own. And I haven't had hardly any of that.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Have you ever spent any time on a men's hospital ward in the middle of London? wow, you know, there is no respite at all. Day and night, there is stuff going on very loudly, just a little curtain. This is the NHS as well, a little curtain, and suffering people actually.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, I can understand it. I remember in your initial letter that you wrote to people about the diagnosis, you were saying you appreciated people's well wishing, but you didn't think you could take them on.
Well, I've had to modify that a bit. I like it too, you know. I really it's lovely to talk to you, for example.
Yeah, it's lovely to talk to you. You were very direct, though. You did say to people, look, the thing that would encourage me most is you getting on with your own Dharma practice and just this is going to happen to you too.
Really, truly.
You should spend time thinking about it.
Because at my age, at the age of most of the people I know, it's not so strange. It's not so unusual for people to be popping their clogs. You know, it's happening all around us. Another friend of ours has died really recently, and after a long cancer illness. And another friend I have has just had an operation for cancer. It's all around us. There's nothing that unusual about mine. And what do you say to somebody? When it happens to me, what do I say? I usually say something, and I feel it. I'm terribly sorry, and I hope you get off lightly or whatever it is. Say a few things. You know. They'll appreciate the words, but it doesn't really.
At
It's
the same
beyond.
time, you are really well loved. You are very well
I
loved.
am real loved. Yes.
And you
As
know
you.
that. You're in touch with it, and that people's sadness and grief is presumably part of it, even if you don't particularly want to have to deal with it all the time, help them through it. So, have you got a chance to rejig your days? Is it going to be like this? Is it kind of out of your control already as a process, or can
And now
you
that I've.
insist on a bit more solitude?
Well, now that it's clear that it can't be, there's no cure and there's no treatment that's going to help me. And I'm straight on to the palliative care team who will just look after whatever needs I have over the next 3 or 4 months or however long it happens to be. There's a clarity there. It's a great relief, actually, not to be treated because, well, now that I know that it's not worth treating me, because. The doctor told me that there's no operation they can do. There's no immunotherapy, there's no radiotherapy. And I could have chemo. I could have chemo, but the likelihood of it having any positive effect whatsoever is 1 in 5 people. It's really clear that there's no point giving yourself the suffering of 6 months of chemotherapy when the results would be very unlikely to be. Anything at all. And he said, you know, that one person, it would only be a tiny increment, you know. So treatment is off. Hospital visits are probably off. There's a few other little things, little details that mean I might need to go into hospital, but I can just die here in this room and I can just spend all my time from now until then looking after myself, practicing and doing stuff like this, which I think is really good. I'm very
Yeah.
lucky.
It was good to read that you've got our friend Damitashuri, who's a Buddhist chaplain, I think, right? She was,
You know
you wrote
her?
this. I do know her, yeah.
Yeah, you do. I knew
We've
it
done, I
actually.
think we've even had a conversation about being a Buddhist chaplain and what that involves. Are you basically comfortable enough? Is your pain level at the moment
Yeah,
fine?
they've given me some opiate drugs, but I'm not taking them. I'm just on paracetamol and I'm okay at the moment. It wasn't like that at the beginning, but now the paracetamol seems to have built up. And now I feel, well, you know, I could go into details about what's happening. It's not necessarily the best topic for the interview.
A lot of people don't have any kind of exposure to this until it's right upon them. And in the past, we've worked with our friend Suvarna Prabha. She did a cancer blog. We did lots of conversations with her about the process of dying. Published a book afterwards of her writing about it, which I think a lot of people found helpful. I've known you for years, and you're known in the community for years as being someone who's just quite focused on the need to practice meditation as a way to take on the essential elements of Dharma practice, like working at ego clinging, looking at your identity, looking at how it causes you suffering, etc. Just as your friend, I've been thinking, well, is it helpful for you to dwell on what's happening in your body, contemplate the processes of it in that quite traditional way of the workings of the body and its impermanence? Is that actually useful for you, or is it just like this is just something that's happening?
I'll tell you later because I don't know. I mean, I'm doing practice, but at the moment, because of the upheaval, that I described earlier on, I really don't feel I'm in a good space for meditation at the moment. I know I will be, but give me a few days. At the moment, I'm still just getting to the point where I can meditate more. You know, I'm doing a sit in the morning, and when friends come around, I sit with them, and I might do a little bit more in the evening. But at the moment, it's all very interrupted. I have constant nausea. That's the main thing. That's my experience. So I need to get myself to drink and to eat against the grain of not wanting to even think about food. That's quite difficult, but I'm getting into it. So to talk about particular practices at this stage isn't very realistic because I'm not doing that kind of practice. But I do feel well prepared by the practices that I've done before. I mean, I feel well ready to do those kind of practices. Sorry, were you talking about the Satipatthana Sutta meditations on the corpse? I've been doing that in recent retreats, and it has been really helpful just to get to the point where you realize, oh yeah, it is going to be happening. Death is going to happen, and it's something quite normal. It's to be expected, and it will happen to you, you know. And that's a big thing for nearly everybody. Everybody, I would have thought. Absolutely. And it's simple. The body is just a thing that has a time limit. Did we say time constrained, you said? Time constrained. We don't recognize that very often, but it's really true. And if you just stop living and you just lie there, the body will go through exactly the same kind of processes as the stuff that's in your trash in the kitchen, or in the compost in your kitchen. It's really literally like that. You know, it has a phase of going furry and kind of stinky, and then it has a phase of drying out, and then it has a phase of disappearing.
It sounds like you're not at the moment resisting it, particularly as a process, to the extent that you are taking it in, because you said earlier, I'm still acting as if it's not going to happen.
What am I supposed to do? I can't say, no, no, no.
But some people really do feel distress when they come face to face with the active impermanence of their life rather than the theoretical impermanence of their life.
Well, ask me later. Maybe, you know, in 3 weeks' time, I'll be a gibbering wreck saying, no, no.
You haven't needed much consolation or comforting or any of that?
I get hugs. I get hugs and I give hugs. I mean, it's lovely being with the Ashwabodhi. It's an interesting phase of our relationship. It's very hard for her.
Yeah.
And it's not as though it's easy for me either. But it's quite hard to qualify what it is that's difficult, actually. Because, you know, we have no idea what is going to happen. We have intimations, maybe, or we have imaginations, mostly imaginations. I have no idea what is going to happen any more than I have an idea of what will happen when I go to sleep at night. It's like that, you know, it's just as unknown as that. And that's been unknown every night of my life. So I don't know what to get upset about. I know, I mean, apart from the fact that I'm not going to be able to do some of the things I was hoping. I had things I was hoping to do, for sure. Loads of things. But having accepted that I'm not going to be able to do that, and I've set up ways for others to do a few of those things. And I'm giving stuff away. I gave my car away the other day. I'm trying to give things up. As I've told you, I don't want to be involved with what we cover in this interview, because it's quite tempting to think, oh yes, I must bring in this about when I was at school and this area is really important. No, I'm not going to do that, because I need to give it up. I need to give this life up and not cling on to it. And I really think that would dig me in even more than I am already, because I you know, I do have my preferences. I do have things that I'd rather people knew about and didn't know about. You know, well, a little bit anyway.
And do you mind being asked about things that are going to take you back into memory or big picture thinking about your life or your role?
I'm kind of expecting that over the next wee while, you will do that.
I can definitely do that. You're right. It's not really an interview, is it? It's a slightly odd conversation across whatever it is, 3,000 miles. It was interesting re-listening to our conversations. And I partly just wanted to hear your voice and get a sense of, what is Kamala Shula's voice consistently in these recorded thingy bobs, whatever they are, right?
My voice, yeah.
In a way, you've got a character as well. You've got a character of Camilla Shelley. You've got a persona you come across.
Yeah,
You talk about certain things.
Yeah.
It's broadly delightful, you know. And these themes came up a lot. And I thought, God, we always end up talking about landscape for some reason.
Oh, yeah.
We do. And it's, I promise it's not just me. We talk about landscape and we talk about meditation and we talk about Triratna.
Yeah.
So again, if you're listening to this and you don't even know who we are, we're both members of a Buddhist order, the Triratna Buddhist order, and you've been in it for a long time.
So have you, mate.
So have I, for some time. For example, I asked another mutual friend of ours, I said, I'm talking to Camel Shield tomorrow, and he said, oh, ask him if he's got any advice for Triratna about meditation. And I said, yeah, I mean, we'll probably talk about meditation, and we've talked about it a lot. I said to him, well, why do you want to ask that? And he said, well, he's basically helped shape the way we think about meditation structurally. He's helped us develop a sense of a tradition and a system that works and ways to engage with that. So what's his advice for us as he's kind of exiting the stage, as it were? Well, maybe it's like that, but I doubt you're carrying a trove of advice.
Are you saying you don't want me to answer the question?
No, I'm just interested in letting you know that that's the sort of thing people want to ask when they hear you,
well,
you particular
time. I think it's a fair question. I've got lots to say about that. I mean, obviously, I can't advise hundreds of thousands of people personally, except this kind of standard kind of advice you get from any half-baked meditation teacher, you know, shamatha, vipassana, what are they called now? The five thingy-me-bobs, you know, all those things do apply. And I'm someone who's had a certain influence, but I'm certainly not the only person who's had a certain influence. About Triratna itself, I like very much the fact that there has been such an emphasis on meditation, which was Sangharakshita's influence. I mean, in a way, he had no choice but to do it like that, because in the 1960s and the 1970s, there was a massive interest in meditation, the Far East. Ever since Madame Blavatsky, people have been interested in weird stuff from the East. And meditation seemed to be like a serious way of getting into spiritual practice. And in those days, it was a completely new concept. You know, this is a huge topic. We had tried Christianity, and a lot of people really got into Christianity, but Christianity didn't have that method. I know they do now. So meditation was huge and had to be. But I think Sangharakshita had such a big idea for Buddhism in the West, that he basically is like one of these people who does a painting very, very quickly. And over his long lifetime, there was still so much that he could only sketch out most of it. You know, it's like doing a bit here, a bit there, and filling in here and filling in there. And I think he himself, you know, he learned a lot from some wonderful teachers, and he understood meditation and practiced meditation. He wasn't the best hands-on teacher. I don't think that was his forte. His forte was communicating the Dharma, you know, in really good words and language. Whereas a kind of hands-on, what we say, a sort of experiential aspect of meditation, it's very difficult to get that across to a lot of people all at the same time, especially if they're very, very inexperienced and still learning about the basics of Dharma. So I think his time for doing that ran out, and it's more my generation that have taken that up. And actually, we have taken up that responsibility of teaching in more hands-on depth, as it were, in quite sort of cobbled-together circumstances as well. So actually, it's not my generation, it's the next generation that will do that much more effectively. It is happening now, and it's happening well. I'm very happy with the way things are developing with people like Prakash and Vasantra, Tejananda, and Vivek and other teachers. But I think that the movement is likely to continue. It's looking good. So I think the ground for disseminating that aspect of the Dharma is getting riper now, while people like me are moving out of the picture. So what you've got is our recorded stuff, our written stuff, and the influence that we have had, which can't really be, you can't quantify it on people individually. It's just this kind of spirit.
It's nice to hear that you're still kind of optimistic about it. I asked you in an interview about 8 years ago, are you optimistic about the future of Triratna? And you said, very, very. It was very strong. So you were like, I'm really optimistic.
I'm an optimist, I'm afraid.
Are you?
Yeah.
Well, you talked about us having clarified our roots and finding that they were good and there was something to build on, which I thought was lovely.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're still optimistic, which is good.
I am. I think all our problems are kind of administrative and to do with the way we run the movement. In my opinion, there's a lot of emphasis on missionary work and running things and getting lots of activities going. And that never helps deep practice. It's throughout the Buddhist tradition, it's like that everywhere. You know, the forest monks tradition came out of that same disparity. You know, very few people really want to explore insight. Very, very few people. And it's always the case. It's probably the case in Tibet. In a Tibetan monastery, you maybe have 5,000 monks and maybe 1,000 of them, or maybe 200 of them, or maybe just 10 of them, are really practicing deeply because we're ready at different times in our spiritual lives, I think. So that affects Sri Ratna, and it's a classic thing. It always happens. I'm not pessimistic because of that. I just think it's normal.
So getting bigger versus going deeper, that's basically...
Yeah.
They're not so compatible in a certain way.
There's nothing wrong with getting bigger. Unless your base in the Dharma doesn't catch up.
Yeah.
Follow what I mean.
It does come from people's urge to share something that they value, doesn't it? But it can so easily turn into that becomes the point of it is we should grow, we should grow, well, we should grow.
It's not hard to give an inspiring talk about how grateful you are to Sangharakshita and the movement and all the great things that have happened, how good this is. And that's a nice, impressive talk, but it doesn't really necessarily say much about the Dharma.
Or what happens next, if you feel inspired, what happens next?
Yeah. I don't think those are very fruitful territory, really. I do feel optimistic just because we do have some pretty good Dharma. And we found ways to communicate it in a world that previously was very bound by tradition, dead tradition. Yeah. And now that's all changed for them as well. I think maybe if we talk about Sri Ratna, I think another thing Sri Ratna needs to do is make many more, it's already happening, of course, but many more connections with other traditions, especially the traditions that are really good on the wisdom side of practice.
Mm.
Just the other traditions who are great missionaries, you know, but tune into people like the Kagyupas and some of the deep practitioners who come from a lineage that is still as live as it was when, you know, Minarepa was around. In some of those traditions, it really is happening in ways that we should aspire to. And we can reach that if we aspire to that ourselves. We do have a little bit of, because we've come out of nothing and we're self-created, we're self-made men and women, as it were, as an organization, we can get stuck in that mode somehow and think that we need to be independent all the time.
It's interesting to hear you talk about this because in a way it's a little bit removed from you personally. It sounds, tell me if I get this wrong, it sounds like over the piece, as you approach the end of your life, you're content with the context you've been in. It's been an adequate receptacle for your practice and way for you to learn and way for you to give and all of that. And you're raising these issues that you see, which seem important. Are you in touch with anything where it's either a matter of regret about the way practice has developed for you as a practitioner in this context or in the community around you? If you could go back and talk to young Kamala Shila as he gets ordained in Thetford Forest, what would be the stuff you're taking back and saying?
I think my greatest regret is staying too long in the institutions of the movement. I didn't practice what I just preached just now. As so many of us did in our generation, we were most concerned above all, with furthering the movement. There's nothing wrong with that. But it means that your energy and your aspirations are all in that realm. And it was a long time before I realized that I was just getting stuck in a role. And even then, I didn't pull out as much as I perhaps should have done. Because I think my history, very briefly, is that, you know, having got involved with starting a center in West London, in London, I went out and helped with starting another center at Vajraloka, which was a meditation center, which is what I really wanted to do. And I did stay there for 15 years. And I was still building the place, creating the place, making it happen. And I was the chair of it. I was the administrative head of it, as it were, of the charity. And that had been the case in London. And then I went on to Sangharakshita had this idea of calling all those people who'd taken on that level of responsibility together and got them to live together. I think we were about 10 or 15 of us living in this vast great house in Birmingham. And it was a great idea, but I really wish I had gone against his advice and his request and stayed at Vajraloka and just deepened the situation there. I think I'm an incurable, because I started so young, I'm a bit incurable as an administrator, wanting to deepen, but I wish I'd deepened that and not gone for this much broader sort of interaction, deepening the movement, going out all over the world, giving talks, blah, blah, blah. That seems to have been, in some ways, a bit of a waste.
Was that what you were trying to redress when you did your very long solitary? Was it 3.5 years?
Yeah, I sort of realized about 3/4 of the way through life in Birmingham, in that community, I realized that I'm not getting anywhere in my spiritual practice. I'm getting a long way in my ability to communicate to large numbers of people and to be a kind of figurehead or something like that, or some kind of influence or some kind of disciple figure. But I'm not doing very much for myself. And I'm afraid that I think quite a number of us got in that kind of a trap. And when I say myself, I just mean my spiritual unfolding, as it were. And at that point, I did see it more and more clearly, and I did something about it, which was basically to leave and to start doing more what I felt were more important things, like retreats and not just promoting Tree Ratna. I don't mean to cast aspersions on other people who are doing the same thing. It's entirely their decision for what they did. And I'm sure, I know also that all kinds of developments, including spiritual development, can come from serving others. I recognize that, but I think that is a little bit overdone in Tree Ratna. A particular mantra is repeated too often.
Picking up that theme of you in the forest on your own when you were doing your long solitary retreat, does that sort of rebalancing of effort in your practice towards deepening and moving into some exploration of insight that felt like it was urgent and vital and not concerned with whether Tree Ratna gets bigger or becomes more international or whatever it is, have you managed to keep hold of the thread of that through all this change in the last, I don't know, 5, 7 years where you developed MS, your contemplative community that you thought about setting up didn't come together? Practicing with other people online as a kind of rolling thunder retreat, as it were. You're always practicing with people.
Yes, I think so. I think it's the most important thing, and it's why I do things. And I mean, I do want to do things with other people. That's helpful for me. I really haven't managed to explore teaching until we discovered online communication. I haven't managed to get the kind of consistency of regular connection with the same people, or roughly the same group of people, until I was 72 or something. I'm 75 now. My teaching career has taken off since the pandemic, basically.
So you haven't seen yourself as a teacher this whole time, even though you've sort of...
Oh, yeah, I have seen myself as a teacher, but for me, it was very difficult to find a platform, actually. For one thing, it's a little bit, at least it has been in the past, a little bit not done to be a teacher in Tree Ratna. I think that's starting to change. There's a lot of confusion about it.
This is relevant to my work. Dharma Chakra has had, I think, since 1967, recordings of talks. And of course, that starts just with Sangharakshita, so it sort of is about him. But very quickly, certainly when I came into the community, there was already a thing about we're not doing big teachers, we're just doing the Dharma. So the emphasis isn't on, even nowadays on Free Buddhist Audio, the emphasis isn't on here's the Kamala Shela collection or here's the Subhuti collection or the Viveka collection. It's very much just thematic around the Dharma.
Yeah, and kind of what you're allowed to do.
Maybe that's what I wondered about in terms of things like regret or even a sense of harmony, being in harmony with one's community and one's context. Is that something that you feel in harmony, even though there is the constraint of a spiritual community that presents itself a particular way and wants a certain approach?
Well, things like that have always been a problem for me. I do think it's a bit unnecessary and incongruent as well, because there was a time when there was just one teacher, right? We didn't pretend, we didn't say, no, this isn't come from Sangharakshita, this is simply the Dharma. He was the teacher, you know, and he was all right with that. Why aren't we okay with the next generation? I seriously do not understand it. It makes no sense to me. And so, trying to answer your underlying question about regret, I think I just realized a long time ago that this is nonsense and I wasn't going to play with it. I wasn't going to do it. So I don't regret it because I don't think I've played that game too much, except when I didn't realize what I was doing.
I remember us going for a walk late night in West Hampstead and having this conversation, frustrations about processes around commonality and in a way trying to deal with the new problems that arise when you've got lots of teachers and they're all part of a lineage and part of a train of disciples of Sangharakshita. Then how do you stay as one community with a core body of teaching that everybody across cultures around the world shares? There's a perfectly reasonable area of interest there. I think the thing we were exploring was, is it out of balance somewhere again with this idea of freedom and agency to practice and to explore the Dharma? So you're saying you don't have regrets in relationship to that because you haven't really got caught up in it, apart from when you went to live at Majjhima Loka, maybe.
I need to look at that more carefully, but that's my...
That's your thing. In terms of harmony then, I suppose moving from regret through to harmony.
There's an element of disharmony around,
there is.
Around all those things, because it's hard to disagree with the orthodoxy. It always is. Everyone's going to find that. And I've always recognized that we need, commonality, that's the word. We need to be as united as we can be. But I think we should only be as united as we can be. And I think there's also room for individual interpretations. I mean, Sangharakshita used to say both. You know, this is Sangharakshita A and Sangharakshita B or whatever it was. He would, on the one hand, really say, you know, the college needs to speak with one voice. The movement needs to have a common front. When you go in any Sri Ratna center, they have to be doing the mindfulness, bringing the message. Well, that's fine. Fine. But there's also diversity. And actually, Sri Ratna people generally seem very, very diverse. If you ask me, it's probably the same with any spiritual organization. They're full of weirdos. They're full of people who don't fit in. And they don't fit in because they have a spiritual aspiration. That is unusual and it's countercultural for many people anyway. So a lot of people, I think it's in any religious organization, are square pegs in round holes. So there's loads of variety, loads of characters and people who think different things. I'm certainly not the only one. What I meant by that, there's all these individualistic people, they do have a lot in common as well. So it's quite possible for Sangharakshita's vision of unity within diversity is totally possible. We just have to practice what he preached. His trouble is he preached something different later on, much more to do with conformity. So that has set up a problem. Maybe it's a good problem.
I totally understand when people I love actually say to me, well, it's really important that people feel free to practice and to explore and experiment. But if it's going to be taught at a center or if it's going to come into the life of the order, it needs to be somehow assessed by some people somewhere. I get that. But there's another bit of me thinks, well, what does it look like to trust a community? And there's a bunch of assumptions underneath that about what happens if you do it differently, what's lost. And quite often, if I push that, someone will say, well, the whole thing could split or it could break up or it could splinter or whatever. And you kind of think, well, is that okay? Do we trust the community will do a kind of organic version of unity through diversity and make it okay or not?
Well, I also think that the level of consultation is ridiculous. I'm afraid I see this around the ordination process. I mean, I'm not qualified to speak about this because I'm not in touch with it, but that's also the problem. It's a very exclusive area. Those who have chosen ordination when they're asked, and nowadays it takes a very, 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 very long time for most people. And no doubt there are good reasons for that, but this is just an illustration of the level of consultation that needs to happen nowadays in many of the institutions of Sri Ratna. It doesn't seem to particularly help, or it doesn't seem to particularly make things spiritually vibrant. In my experience, at least, it tends to make things feel very muddy.
You're recognizing that there's a degree of discomfort, even disharmony, with aspects of the context you've been in and how it's developed and how it will develop without you in future. But you're not actively in disharmony with people, by the sounds of it. You're not kind of...
I don't think so. Maybe one or two, if we came to it, we might argue. I don't know. But I think on the whole, all the people I think of who are my peers or the same generation as myself, I think, well, I like them all, really, even the ones I disagree with. You know, I don't have any outstanding battles going on.
Well, that's good to hear.
As far as I know. Anyone listening now who feels you happy can contact me. I'm still here. Just
I know there isn't a solution to this particularly, but what would you encourage people to do then, just with an awareness of this problem, that the whole thing can get a bit too much or something, or a bit too...
It was like, leave or do your own thing. Do something different for a while. It doesn't matter.
Have we lost a spirit of something? Is that kind of attention?
It can definitely come back. We had a system once, and we now have the semblance of it, and that was that different bunches of order members went and started centres in different parts of the world, different parts of the country, and they were separate charities. Nowadays, they try and join them up. The system is still there, but they're advised to choose particular people. There's a bunch of people who like to have an influence on who becomes the chair, who becomes the president, who fulfills the official roles. They like them to be the right people. That is a complete change. Because in the days when we trusted the community, each centre would be very different, sometimes radically different. But the interesting thing is, it's still the same. They're still often very different. I think Ari Lohkin is very, very different from the LBC, for example. The differences remain. So I'm still optimistic.
So it turned out there's a culture in that sense, and there's a spirit in it that is intact, basically.
Maybe it's simply that it's adapted to new circumstances, because we have these different generations coming through who think completely, obviously, you know, my generation wanted to have nothing to do with my parents' generation. And then the next generation, they want to have everything to do with their parents' generation, but it's going to be different from now on, etc. And so the kind of social conditions have changed a lot in society from the 1960s. But at the same time, I do have the sense that the spirit just takes different forms. That just sounds a bit romantic and fluffy, but I do feel that, of my observation. I mean, there's a lot of old colonel type of people, and I'm not talking about the institutional people, I'm talking about the rebels of the order, the older people who just hate everything that's happened, hate all the way it's gone at the moment, and they don't realise it's just another generation.
Does it matter to you still? Like, personally, does it matter to you?
I'm popping my gloves. I'm looking forward to the great day when I die. So I'm leaving all this stuff behind. So I know I don't care. Why should I? What's going to happen if I do or I don't? I'm just going to get anxious about it. It's pointless. It's going to take its own course. You can't do anything about what other people do, hardly. You can say, oh, I don't like that, but that's not necessarily going to have any effect. Or they might take it into account in the way that they want to take it into account. There's no hope in that way.
But there is gratitude, isn't there? You're not despairing of your community in the face of the impossibility of affecting the future. You've been in something that's been meaningful, presumably.
I'm not grateful for everything, you know.
No.
But yeah, sure. I'm very grateful to whatever it was that produced this phenomenon of the order and the movement, even though there are aspects of it that
you're not grateful for. Well, do you want to say what you're not grateful for? Would that be helpful to say? Would it be?
I've told you about those things.
Okay, so it's those
just
things.
Just approaches and sort of slightly cult-like characteristics that all big organizations have. I realize now, I haven't always known. I'm sure if we were talking about Microsoft.
It'll be interesting to listen to this back afterwards to think how much of this is actually going to be interesting to an audience.
How do you tell those things without asking me? No, you decide.
That's right, you do decide. It has to be somewhat informed, but you do decide.
But you have a sense, haven't you, of what will be useful and listenable to, and that's...
Yeah, I do, and it's limited by my perspective.
I'm very grateful to you having, you know, developed that sense, because that's the fruit of all your labours, isn't it, really? One of the great fruits.
One question I had just for myself was, have you been surprised by anything in the last few weeks where you've thought, I remember when I got ordained, I had this really strong sense of, oh my goodness, what a fool. Like, I thought it was going to be like this, but it's actually like that. And I'm sure now, if I actually think about what I thought it was like then, it's probably wrong too. But have you been surprised by anything that's come up since you've had the certainty of this is it? This is me facing the great day, as you called it.
I'm a bit shocked that I feel so good about it. That just seems a bit weird to me, but then I don't mind, obviously.
Why does it seem weird? Given how much practice you've done, why would you not trust
Well,
it to have worked?
we can find explanations for it, sure, but at the same time, it's quite real. I do feel quite good about it. And it's not the drugs talking yet. I'm not on any significant drugs. But that's a bit of a sort of a gentle surprise, really. To the extent, I'm not sure what to say. Yeah, that's been a bit of a surprise. What else? I've been surprised how difficult it is. It is actually really difficult. Subjectively, physically, it's quite difficult. I might look as if I'm perfectly normal sitting here, but honestly, there's some aspects of this, particularly the nausea, which is very tough. There's no easy solution to it. And that surprised me. You know, when we started talking about palliative care, I thought, oh, well, I'll be cruising now until the big day, but not at all. It's quite hard. Yeah, that's a surprise.
Do you have any dread or anxiety in relationship to pain, things like that
I
that are
don't
going to come?
think so. You see, at the moment, anyway, I don't know what to dread. What should I dread? I don't have a sense of it being unknown. No, does that make sense?
Even though it's a voyage into the unknown, that sort
Well,
of.
yeah, that's right. It's the unknown. It really is the unknown. And, you know, for all I know, in like 3 months' time, I'm going to be having a weird conversation with a demon, you know, or something like that after my death. How can I anticipate what's going to happen? I cannot, you know, I really can't. And I don't anticipate anything like that. And it could be that it's different for everybody. And I sort of look forward to, I like to look forward to exploring it.
You want to find out?
I want to find out. Yeah.
Do the traditional Buddhist paradigms for dying and rebirth and all of that, are they useful at the moment? Or are they just kind of
Yes,
like,
I think they are. I think they are very, very useful. Not even only the Buddhist ones, but all of them really. And they're all equally pointing at something they don't know. I mean, even the Book of the Dead, you know, purports to be kind of a literal account, but it can't be a literal account. It can be an account based on yogic experience that really does, in some way, intuit the after-death state. But even then, you get the bardo of death, and then you get the bardo of reality after that. The content there is completely mythical, and it makes sense to one's heart, but I think one is not supposed to take it literally. I'm planning to reread Padmasambhava's Terma, of which the Book of the Dead is part. I want to start that really soon because I remember when we'd done a couple of retreats around it, and I remember the content was so compelling just simply because it was still pointing at the unknown. It was still pointing at something unquantifiable and unqualifiable, really. It managed it very well. It's because of this territory of subjective and objective experience, because of the world appearing and there being no real explanation for why it appears as it appears, except various Buddhist explanations. It appears like this because of the conditions of your body and mind. So you appear or you experience a world that is coterminous with that. So at the moment, you or I are not experiencing a rabidly paranoid, terrifying world. That's only because we're relatively sane and our lives are relatively sorted out. Other people are experiencing terrifying, awful experiences of a world. And I can see very clearly that that is how the bardo arises. And I do believe that physical death is not the end of experience. I think that seems to go against everything else in nature. Things end, but they're not cut off. There's always a process that continues in every respect, all the different elemental changes, biological changes, etc. I
Can I ask
believe.
why you think that extends to consciousness? Obviously, we're animals, we die. You described very well at the start of the conversation the furriness and the breakdown and the drying and the
Oh,
elements go on, but why consciousness without an explicit basis, as it were?
because we don't actually know. We know that the body is a basis in many ways. We don't know that it's the basis in every way. We also know that the phenomenon of, you might call it consciousness, I call it manifesting a world, is something deeply mysterious. Nobody knows why or how it happens. And we also know from the dream state, this is where the Bardo Tardal teachings are helpful because it goes through all these different bardos. We also know that the dream state, in other words, what happens when you go to sleep and consciousness arises in another world, which is completely believable, we don't really understand that. I mean, people think, yes, because you ate too much cheese the night before, but it's not necessarily like that. So we already know you can't explain it. This is not an argument that proves that consciousness is not entirely dependent on physicality. But it's an argument that suggests that it could be. And it seems more likely to be than not. You know, you say we have this kind of probability calculations, but we think some things are more likely than others. Why? Well, it's often quite irrational. For example, the majority of people probably believe that death is simply annihilation and then you can just relax. No, you're not here. Anyway, you just relax. I don't see that that's rational at all. Except on the basis that the body is supposed to be the carrier of consciousness. Well, I think that's a belief. It's not proven. It's not proven scientifically. We don't know how likely it is, really. And we don't always have to come from that scientific probability-based thinking over other realms, such as that of dream and all kinds of weird stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of get that it's complex arising and nobody knows ultimately what that looks like and why it
manifests the way
it does.
Nobody coming from the scientific mindset knows.
Nobody, period, knows.
We are identifying with the scientific mindset. I do as well. It's because of our conditioning.
Well, the question I had is more to do with, I think, something you talked about. We were talking about sadhana a couple of years ago, and you were talking about why people resist that context as a way to work with practice, with ego clinging, with moving towards insight. And you were saying, well, basically, it's weird, it's religious, it requires you to adopt a particular framework.
Particular name.
Yeah, but you were saying, well, actually, the antidote to that, if you can get past the form of it, part of the reason people resist is they don't want to take it literally. They don't want to start thinking they know what it's like and this is what it's like. And you were talking about a soft playfulness as the mode that you're looking for in doing that practice. And so that's what comes up for me here, listening to you talk about the uncertainty of what happens next with the manifestation of worlds.
A kind of exploratory, experimental approach. I mean, that's the great thing about science. It's supposed to be exploratory and it's supposed to be there's some kind of consensus around, but science ends up being a bit fixed because everyone believes. There's a load of belief, isn't there, in the popular world anyway, not amongst actual scientists. Actual scientists are off the scale in terms of the weird things that they believe. But I'm getting beyond myself.
Actual scientists that I've met are quite happy to say I do not know. And they want to look at the evidence. And of course, you can critique the kind of evidence they value, et cetera, or the kinds of processes. But they want to see what seems to me important about that is they don't want to assert, like they're not interested in assertion as a basis for the future. Well, you can call it what you like. You can say this is what's going to happen to Chiratna or me or whoever, but you've absolutely no idea. Like it doesn't, it's not like that.
Well, I like to think that I'm like that, really. I mean, maybe that's the best position for a sort of 21st century person with the condition that we have to adopt the view that we don't know. Well, there are dangers in that, of course, in a purely agnostic view, because it's just an easy let off. Oh, I'm agnostic. I'm agnostic. I don't take any position. It's bollocks, you know, because then you're not taking account of what you actually really think. It's a position to take where you can remain sitting on the fence. Now, I think real scientists don't do that either. And I like that. But anyway, I think to go back to your thing about a more playful, exploratory, experimental attitude to practice, I really think that's absolutely essential. Because things can come out of nothing you weren't expecting. It's absolutely essential. You can't meditate without it, really. You can't get anywhere in meditation or even in a conversation without opening up to yourself thinking something different in 2 minutes' time.
You've just evoked agnosticism in a particular way, right? So you've said the risk is it's just the kind of intellectualizing way to sort of anesthetize yourself against.
I honestly think a lot of people take refuge in it.
Right. Is the soft, playful thing, is the genuinely experimental thing, the road into, you know, Padmasambhava's I do not know, I do not have, I do not understand as a dynamic state, as a kind of living from that place?
Well, I thought so, yeah. I mean, that's a quotation from something or other, which is often quoted. It makes it sound as though he is an agnostic.
It's never occurred to me that that's a statement of agnosticism.
I'm trying to practice what I preach. I never thought about it before. But people often say that, and I think, it's bucks. Because of the way they're quoting it. They're quoting it as an example. He has no view.
No, it's definitely not. I'm not quoting it because I'm saying Padmasambhava has no view. Yeah, but I'm interested in our conversation. There is something about that that I've always found inspiring, partly because as an individual, I tend to too much certainty. That's my kind of shadow side. That's the thing I've always had to kind of work with, or that's always made it more difficult for other people. So I found that really useful to hear it, not because it was a statement of you can't know anything or something, but more like, gosh, what would it be like to live confidently from that place? Mm-hmm. And whenever the few times in my life I've really managed to sort of live from the Dharma or something, it's that thing of confidence in the Dharma is much better than self-confidence. Yeah. There's a relief in it. I feel relieved in it with dukkha.
So what do you find yourself doing instead of that?
Instead of
living from that position of not knowing, being able to play, what do you end up doing?
I probably subtly go for refuge to structures and contexts and relationships that matter to me, that I really care about. And, you know, maybe it's analogous to your time at Majjhimaloka. I sort of misread involvement with all of that as being the same as what I need to do to move further into that state of softness and experiment and all of that stuff. And I think, you know, self-assertion is such a habit. It's such a deep, and it's not a habit from some sort of conscious place of, I think I know what I am and I want to assert it. It's almost like, I don't know how to do anything different until I have experiences where I do.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, remembering that and coming back to that and attending to that. I've always found poetry a space.
Yeah.
It sort of conduces to that somehow. It's a bit hard to say why it conduces to that, but there's a sort of, what's the liminal space, isn't it? There's a kind of thinner space that you can go into that somehow gets created, and it's safer to let go. It's closer to a proper refuge or something. Does that make any sense?
It does, yeah. Yeah.
Does the world feel thinner now? Is the thin place not yet?
Not yet. It's a big ask, having just moved to London. It felt thinner in Suffolk.
Oh.
Just because we never saw any other human beings, or we often didn't see any other human beings for days. And so the way I experienced the world was very, very different. And I haven't really adjusted to being in London. I know it's maybe a bit of a trite answer just to do with the environment I'm in, but...
No, I don't think it's trite at all. We've always talked about landscape and its effect on your mind. And
trying to avoid it, but it's come back again.
It's come back in again. Well, at the start, you said, I love being in London. London's great. So it's like, it's not just one thing, is it?
This is one reason I regret having a limited time space. I won't be able to explore London another decade like I hope to. Because I love London. My roots are in London, really. And this has been a good move. We've got a very nice place. And it's much more than that. It's the people. It's the people of this part of our South. London's amazing. It's completely new to me. Well, it's a long time since I've spent any real time here, since my childhood, because I spent some of my growing up in Lewisham, South London, and such places. And this has the vibe. This has that vibe.
What is the vibe?
Well, I think all these houses around here where I am, I'll show you on the other camera. This is where I am. And it's not showing the skyscrapers in the background because it's all hazy. But around here, all these houses, they were built for office workers and workers, basically.
Mm.
It's sort of turn of the century, late Victorian, early Edwardian. There's the First World War and the Second World War. There's a real sense that people lived here for a long time. There was a lot of suffering. a lot of bombing, a lot of privation. You know, some of the bombing around here was extreme, especially around the South Bank area, which isn't very far from here. We're quite close to Vauxhall and the South Bank. I should try and write a poem about the vibe because I can smell it. I went to school in Lewisham for a while. This is like six or something. And I can remember walking along the roads and having having my thoughts, I wouldn't say anything about them, and looking at the pavements and all sorts of things you do, looking at bits of rubbish. And there's a vibe that's there that isn't anywhere else. There you go. That's the best I can do.
That was good. It reminds me of, we talked sometime in West Hampstead.
I can talk loads more about it, but it would be like that.
I'll be happy to record hours of you just talking like that. It reminded me of the conversation we had about gonzo psychogeography, Padmamati's lovely idea of gonzo.
Yeah, he got in there as well.
Right. That's right. Psychogeography. And we were talking about squatting as a kind of early manifestation in Sri Ratna. That was partly how it all came together, was people living in those sorts of ways. And when you remember that and you're remembering walking through a landscape and it's Lewisham and it's got a vibe and it's echoing with now, because you're back in South London and you're trying to connect that up and think, what is the vibe? I suppose I was wondering, particularly that aspect of it where there's been massive bombing and people's homes have been destroyed and they're living in a new way or something because the landscape's been changed around them. I was wondering if that had also echoed when you were in your early 20s and getting involved in squatting and the landscapes were bombed out.
I didn't recall those times when I was in the 20s. It was much more the building the Buddha land and stuff like that, you know, these high ideals of building communities.
Right.
We will build single-sex communities and we will live in them and we will communicate authentically and we will do all this cool stuff. We will meditate. We will realize enlightenment. It's all very much up here, as young people can be, in a delightful way.
And so squatting was just a practical way to do that in a way, because it was available.
Yeah,
and
you didn't have to pay for it. In those days, that was cool. Nowadays, that's a bit, you didn't want to pay for it. What's wrong with you?
That's right. They have to find new ways to be naive and radical.
Changed. Things are completely changed.
Well, it's interesting to hear about the vibe. I'd love to read your poem about the vibe of Lewisham. It really struck that you said the thinness in Suffolk was closer in a way, but there's people in London.
Well, I think I am a bit of a nature person, and I really get off on there being no people around.
The thing is, you're not actually a misanthrope, are you?
You don't have to be a misanthrope to enjoy solitude. That's the kind of assumption that people just have. They think, oh, therefore they don't like people. That's nonsense. I mean, the human realm is part of the natural realm. Interestingly, we used to think they were different things. But I think that's all gone now, and that's a good thing. Man and nature, you know, these kind of high concepts. Humanity versus Garden of Eden or something like that. That's all crap. That's most, well, I suppose it's still there in Trump land, isn't it?
Hopefully not in national parks. Hopefully it still survives in national parks or Hampstead Heath.
Sooner or later, if things go the wrong way, people will be thinking of national parks as something wrong.
An exploitable resource.
Wrong. It's wrong. It's wrong to glorify nature. Who knows what the future may bring? I won't be here, thank goodness.
And it is, thank goodness.
Like, sorry, I'm being flippant. I apologize.
That's okay. That's okay. You're allowed to be flippant.
It's too easy, though.
One of the impressions I have in this conversation is that I'm glad of it, because I think when I was coming into it, I felt a little bit apprehensive. I thought, well, how do you talk to somebody about all this? I think my inkling was it's too soon to have a conversation that's already retrospective about something that's only unfolding now, which is sort of played out in a way. You're like, ask me in a few weeks' time. I think there is a value, isn't there, about normalizing this, normalizing that you know somebody for a long time and then they die.
I think there's a value in familiarizing ourselves with the truth of it and bringing it out of the cupboard, the taboo cupboard. It sort of is, but it's still a sort of trendy topic. It's not really grounded in culture. I mean, I do know people, I know of people who actually refuse to talk about death, even when it's actually happening. It is possible to do that. It is possible not to experience your own death, you know. So I think the path out of that sort of, I don't know, is it modernist or non-traditional or something? Whatever happened to society after the Enlightenment and the Renaissance, whatever happened there, the path out of that, the kind of people talk about the re-enchantment of the world, or they talk about re-souling the world and all that stuff, which always has a bit of a bias towards something or other they're interested in, some weird sort of New Age thing that they're interested in. But there's something in it, you know, that we all crave, I think. I think the path towards that is still very, very difficult. And the forces that prevent that are very, very strong.
Yeah, there's a lot of conditioning, isn't there?
They're all in America.
They're all in America. I think some of them might be in London, my friend.
It's not, it's just over there, yeah.
Hey, I mean, I hope we obviously get to have more conversation.
Drawing to a conclusion, I can tell.
Yeah, well, we could talk all day, or at least I could listen to you all day. Are you up for having more conversations, or is this more like somebody dropping in on you?
Of course.
Hey, well, listen, thanks for making time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for talking to me, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Would you be happy to lead a little practice? Does that feel relevant or not?
Well, what should we do?
We were just identifying the value in just normalizing this. If you're normalizing something, what is it? What is it brings people closer to that? Just in a simple reflection. One of the reasons you wanted to communicate about it or said yes to people like me is because you want people to reflect that this is going to happen to them. This is an aspect of life.
Okay, I've got an idea.
Thank you.
So this is going to be a very simple meditation on mindfulness of death. As with any meditation, just stop where you are in your seat. And simply rest in the present moment of your experience. Feeling the structure of the body supporting, preferably upright sitting, although it's probably just as good lying down. And feel the gravitational, feel the weight bearing down on the pelvic bones from the skull down through the spine, the rib cage, and the pelvis itself, letting the legs relax. And letting the whole ribcage area open. So letting the heart a bit more space, and letting the scapula, the shoulder bones, relax down the back. Notice anything that's going on, any sounds, Any physical experiences or touches within the body? And just staying with the body experience so that you can observe the whole thing, quieting down in its own way. This may not be particularly easy, just relaxing may. At first, at least, not come so easily. That's okay, it will do. Just give it time. And trust the process. Breath can come and go however it likes. And in this meditation, we're just going to be noticing experiences that are already present, but as yet unnoticed. So the body continues to settle whatever else is happening. One thing that we may notice is the overall feeling of the body itself that has been born. This body, with its particular texture of skin and bone, of flesh, heat and cold. Was once born from our mother's womb. Was no doubt not an easy process. Maybe you can imagine the sensations of being in the womb, the heat, cold, the movement, the closeness, and the sense of knowing, in the sense of not knowing, like being in a dream. Still letting each breath come as it wants to come and go. Let your mind dwell, let your thoughts dwell on the truth of birth. The particular way that this body and mind have emerged into the world. Into the world of reaction, world of change, the world of desire, the world of hatred, joy, happiness, and disappointment. And has also been a basis for wisdom, understanding, pity, and compassion. All of this And as we relax in this space, the physical body and the mind, we recollect also that this organism made of earth, water, fire, and air. Must come to an end in some way. That, like any biological form, when the life force has gone. Processes of dissolution are inevitable. And we can feel right now the water in our mouth, the solidity of our frame, its warmth. And its movement, internal and external. We know that all of this must end. Earth must dissolve. Water must dissolve. Must dry up. Fire must go out. And that even the animating wind element within the body will simply stop. So without thinking about this too much, we just simply accept the truth of it. That's all we need to do. We don't need to speculate as to what it'll feel like or what it'll look like. Just let that basic truth of the impermanence of body and mind, we just let that be as it is. Knowing also that this is something all beings share. It's a truth that underlies everything. Coming into being and passing away. We just continue to rest in this space for a couple more minutes and then we'll finish. And you can reflect upon it again later on, if you'd like to. It will probably always be of some benefit. Just to recall the nature of the body. The nature of the world that seems to be different. Okay, that's it. Thanks very much. See you again.
See you soon.
All the best.
And you. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Love. Bye.